Hello, this is the Torg Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Mark and Lehman, and today we will be talking about the Ruins of the Living Land, which is a small little booklet. First came out as a PDF. You can find it on DriveThruRPG, as well as later it came out as a physical booklet soft cover. But going along the same line that we had with the beta clearance primers that a lot of people don't know about that has some good information in it, I thought that going through some of the other booklets and PDFs would be a good thing to do, because there's a lot of neat and interesting things in these books. We haven't gotten any emails, but if you do wish to email us, you can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com, and you can write us, ask us questions. We'll answer your questions. You comment, we'll comment on your comments. So let's just dive into Ruins of the Living Land. It starts off with says Storm Knight options, but the first thing is salvage and repair. And basically, in the Living Land, one of the laws is the law of decay, which states that non-living things will decay. So your vehicles are going to rust, and your guns are going to stop working, and such like that. Items break down quickly under the influence of law of decay. And what this is about is how to repair things. So they basically say if something breaks and you want to repair it, you can use science. And the base difficulty number is how complex it is. Easy would be something with one or two moving parts. That's a DN of 8. A motor with hundreds of complex pieces is very hard. A DN of 16. Something advanced technology that requires repairs to microcircuits is nearly impossible of a 20. And then in addition to that difficulty number, you also might have a modifier if you don't have the correct parts or tools, which a game master would apply somewhere between a -2 and a -6. It also says if an item uses a specific skill, a Storm Knight may use that skill's adds plus their mind. So what that would be is if you're trying to repair a compound bow, you could use your missile weapons, but instead of with dexterity, you would use it with mind. So, Mark, what are your thoughts on the salvage and repair living land rules?
So the rot and decay, the law of decay, is like integral to the living land. It just is part of what. As much as people don't want to go to a Rorsch because of how horrific it is and bad, and it's the Gaunt Man's home turf, nobody wants to go to the Living Land, or they used to not, because the Law of Decay really, really hit you hard in original Torg. I remember playing original Torg, and when we knew we were taking a mission into the Living Land, there were certain items that we left at home because we absolutely didn't want to risk them, because we knew going in there, we could lose them. Mm-hmm. Now, Torg Eternity has gotten a little softer on that, in my opinion, in that there's no longer the now, your mileage may vary, your cosm may vary, but there's not as much risk to your favorite item or your trademark weapon or vehicle or whatever that there used to be. You can get a cosm card that you can choose to give up an item, and based on how much or how little that item means to your Storm Knight determines how many possibilities you earn for giving it up. Mm-hmm. But it's still a choice. It didn't used to be a choice. So the Law of Decay really, to me, sets a lot of the tone for the Living Land, as much as, and this is, I don't know how we fix this, but I think it's a failing in Torg Eternity that the Deep Mist, it doesn't play a bigger role in the Living Land as much as it used to. Mm-hmm. It seems like it used to be a lot more pervasive and ubiquitous and always there, and now it's just kind of a flavor thing. So use the Deep Mist, use the Law of Decay, and in a home game, I think salvage and repair as a, we were talking about this before we started, salvage and repair really should have been included somewhere much more highlighted than a PDF or a softback book somewhere, because that to me is like super useful for a living land heavy campaign, especially if you're gonna start rotting and decaying, use that law of decay and knock stuff down, and you come up with a way to take vehicles or constructed things, especially stuff that that exceeds the tech axiom and maybe the social axiom to a little bit, whatever however, when you get above those that just push those boundaries, the law of decay really gets offended at that and starts knocking wheels off of carts and stuff like that. And you need somebody that can salvage and repair. And to me, the salvage part is very reminiscent of the post-apocalyptic kind of feel that the living land can have when it's done, in my opinion, when it's done right. Very much like walking through the jungles of, downtown Atlanta or downtown New York or whatever that has been overgrown, and you've got these images of skyscrapers and underpasses draped, festooned with vines and carnivorous plants and herds of gazelle moving through, or whatever herd animals moving through, like Central Park and stuff like that. That salvage is, oh, you know what? We found a carburetor that hasn't rusted to death in under a hood somewhere, protected in a parking garage, and we need one. Oh, cool. Okay, let's get that to our mechanic, and he'll get our Humvee running again, or whatever it is, And that to me is, I don't want to make it a main storyline. You could, but it would become a very, very cool side quest. That, we've got these things that we like, that we would like to use more, if only they would run more frequently.
So let me ask you this on your thoughts. So we're talking about the law of decay, which can come into play through the Cosm card law of decay, which you rightly stated, the player picks what item they wish to decay, and then depending on how important or valuable the game master thinks that item is, or the player can convince the game master how valuable that item is, then they get possibilities for that. Would you have that item simply just decay into nothingness, or would you say allow if somebody gave up something and then spent time or during the adventure was, I'm looking for this thing to something that I could use to fix it, and then allow the salvage and repair. Not just I'm going to fix it right now, but perhaps a as we're moving along, I'm toying with things to eventually fix this.
So are you mean like hinting at these things are beginning to degrade, or just they worked and now they don't, and now I need to fix it?
Right, like through the actual Cosm card. Somebody plays the Cosm card, and you're like, okay, I don't really have a lot of stuff. I guess I'm gonna have to, because you have to get rid of something. And you're like, I have armor and I have my pistol. And I feel I need my armor to protect me more than I need this pistol to shoot. So I'm gonna say that my pistol is affected by the law of decay,
Oh, I see
but
where you're going. Okay.
I don't like the idea of for the rest of this adventure, or at least till the end of the act, because maybe you just started the act and this happened, of oh, not having the pistol. So would you just say the pistol's gone, or would you say, okay, every scene give me a find to see if you might have been able to pick up something, or like you said, you've come across an army, the U.S. Army had a convoy that everybody disconnected in, and maybe there's a weapon catch that has the appropriate part. Would you allow that as a Cosm card, not just in general?
Okay, so do you want home game answer, or do you want organized play answer, or do you want both?
Let's do both.
Okay, so home game answer. I like the idea of Mark likes subsystems. I tend to make my life as a GM overly complicated, and then I forget the things that I set up that I thought were really cool when I built them, and then I have to adjudicate them on the fly and like, oh crap, I should have been doing this and I haven't. So I like the idea of, let's say, armor that has, let's say it has AP4 on, or it has armor 4. I don't know what armor it is. Like air meshes 4, I think, or something along those lines. So let's say you take air mesh that's armor 3 or armor 4 into the living land, and you're wearing it. So you're using it. It's not just in your backpack, you're toting it around, you're using this. I might start to degrade the armor value. I might, but it really depends on, in the past, what I've done is, oh, you've played the card, you've given it up, it's gone, here are your possibilities. It's a what it's an exchange, right? And we kind of have that discussion about what you, the player, think the item is worth, and what I, the GM, think it's worth, and we come to an agreement, and then I hand you the possibilities, and you strike the item from your character sheet, and we go on. And that's the simplest and easiest way to do it from a gameplay standpoint, so that the game keeps moving, and you've accounted for the mechanic, you've got a little bit of the feel of what the Cosm does, because everybody's going to complain when that card hits the table, because they all know, oh shit, I'm losing something. I got to figure out what I'm losing now. If I weren't overly burdened with a bunch of other things going on at the time that that card hit the table, I might come up with a way that it degrades over time. And as those, like if it had armor 3, and that's the armor you're wearing, degraded a point. Here's a possibility. Degraded a point. Here's a possibility. Degraded a point, it's falling apart. Here's a possibility, it's useless now. So you got your three possibilities out of it. Your armor is now gone. And as I degrade it over the course of time, when I remember, boom, there's a possibility. And you, as the player, are going, oh shit, when is he going to go take my armor down another point? And so you've got that whole flavor of the law of decay stretched out over time, which to me, I think is ideal. And then later on, what I might allow is like that Delphi Council support card to come into play. And I might let you just play that, and if you roll well, you get your armor, get some appropriate armor from, not necessarily your armor back, but something comparable or close or better than you're running around naked now and you got nothing on, you will be happy to have any armor. So you might have been stacking furs on, looking very Living Lands to get that plus one from the furs. And now you've got a ballistic vest and you're very happy to have a bleed. This is not my ideal, but it's better than what I had before, right? And that's how I might run with that, to give that whole Law of Decay feel. That's kind of my home game approach to it. To organize play is, to me, is more the to organize play approach kind of has to be more of the former,
The exchange, this equals this, and
yep, let's
clear
do this
cut.
now, get it done, and we're over with. And the way that the to organize play GM, I think, has no choice but to approach this one, you have to go, okay, what's written on your character sheet? You can't say, well, I've been saying I'm doing this and you're doing this, and that means I have to have this kind of thing with me to do it. Well, yeah, it does, but that's kind of thematic because it's not crunch. And the organized campaign kind of requires a little more crunch than the home game or a thematic statement, because if you're going to play that Cosm card, you have to lose something. And that something can only be what you have written on your character sheet. And so that lower left-hand corner on the roll 20, we play almost everything is roll 20 right now. On roll 20, in the lower left-hand corner of your character sheet, is this list area for gear and other things that aren't, in those other boxes for weapons and armor and things of that nature. That's where I start looking for items and to see what they have rolling around. And now we start having our negotiations about what we're going to wipe out. And a lot of times I'll try and sit down so that I don't want the to organize play GMs to be the bad guy and to say, okay, I'm taking your trademark weapon. Because if you get somebody's perk driven item and decay it, you give them three possibilities would be my knee-jerk reaction, but they're going to get you the player, not out that thing. It's not gone. The end of the act, in between acts, you're just like the replacement stuff says, you can replace it because you paid your perk, you paid your XP for it. It's a perk. It's part of your character, but you suffered the consequence during the act or during the mission, right? So that's kind of how to organize play. You have to be a little more adjudicating the way I, so that I'm not the bad guy. I kind of figure out how many items there are on the character sheet that could possibly be lost. And then I'll do a slash RD, whatever the number is, D13. And then the way I counted them to figure out how many there are, that's the way I count down until I hit the number that it rolled and say, that's the item that's gone. Mm-hmm. And I do that openly so that the player is seeing, I say, okay, here's how I'm counting it. And I typically will start over there in that gear column and count down and get everything, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then I come over here and start hitting armor and weapons and whatever you've got listed that's actual stuff. And so the players will hear me count and then roll that die and the number comes up. So they know which one they're losing because I counted it. I haven't done it that way in organized play before because it just occurred to me that I'm like, oh, shit, they don't know how I count that. But that's – they see the number I rolled.
Mm-hmm.
And then they – I tell them, well, that's this one. I was counting through it, and it's this item right here. So they have to trust me that I counted it the same way. But that's – you really don't have much of a choice otherwise, I don't think. I'm sure that there are other ways other GMs do it. And however, I'm not telling anybody who's GMing into organized play, I'm not telling you this is how you have to do it. I'm saying that's how I do it. If you've got another method or you want to let your players pick it or whatever, rock on. That's, you know – as we say in organized play, your mileage may there your cosm may vary. There might be some table variation.
Right, and I believe when we went through the cosm cards, we talked about it. The cosm card I believe has the player's pick, but I do remember us discussing that you don't allow stupid things like my left sock.
No,
unless you say okay. But you're going to have a fungal infection for your sweaty foot in your boot, and that's going to make you stymied until the end of the act when you can clean it up or, you know, something like that.
That works for home game.
Right.
Yeah, that works for home game. But from a organized play standpoint, that's the part where I was like, ephemeral things that aren't really – it has to be written on the character sheet to get the possibilities. If you want to lose your left sock and get a fungal infection that has no game, and okay – the card hit the table. Something's got to go.
Well, yeah, I guess I said in a home game with that card, I would make it it either has to be on – it has to have some game effect of not having it. If it doesn't have a game effect, then it's not a loss. You know, and if you're saying I lost my left sock, no. If you're saying I lost the left sock and that's going to cause me to be stymied every round because of – then I would say, okay, that's kind of, okay, cool idea. I'll run with that as a game master. But I'm not just going to allow things that don't have any type of effect.
So, how do I say this? I don't want to, I'm not calling anybody out. Mm-hmm. I've been playing games for 30 plus years, long time. Right. I've seen all kinds of different players and they do different things.
Right.
What I'm not going to allow in Torg Eternity, when these cards are played, they're designed to add flavor and the unexpected to the game. And everybody grows from that. And your character, you have to react to something. Oh, I didn't see that coming. And they're always the Cosm cards are called Cosm cards because they're flavored. Like the cosm you're in. In this case, we're talking about the Living Land. So this is the law of decay. And do you want to lose stuff? No, nobody wants to lose stuff. What I'm not going to permit, and you kind of said it there, is I'm not going to permit a player to – I'm giving up this thing, and there's zero impact to the player.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't – they might like, well, I don't want any possibilities, so I'm not giving anything up. Well, that's not how this works.
Right. You have to give something worth at least one possibility.
There role. We're playing a game and everybody has to have fun. I get that. But there has to be some level of risk involved to the character. Or there's no point, then why roll dice?
Right.
Just do a
Just
thematic
narrate.
storytelling. Yeah, just narrate the thing, because you want it to come out the way you want it to come out, rather than the way that the dice dictated it comes out and the random chance comes up, which is what, in my opinion, is fun about it, is I wanted it to go this way and all of a sudden it's taken a right turn and we're going sideways. How do I deal with that? Right? That's what makes the cool story, because it's not this linear thing that we all saw coming and we railroaded to the end. We took this cool path that no other table is going to take, because it didn't have the unique group of people that we had at our table, and we reacted to it differently than that table. And here's the cool story that we got to do that's our story. You had a similar story, but it isn't our story. We did it. And here's the cool, by the way, here are the cool parts we did. We had a fungal infection we had to deal with. Fungal infection isn't very cool. Oh, you didn't see how bad his foot was rotting off, and said, and that's the cool story in that table versus the other table. That's to me, to your point, I'm not letting you zero it out so it doesn't have any effect. If you don't like that, don't play the game, because that's the point of the game and the cards, is they do that kind of stuff. So off we go.
And to full circle back to salvage and repair
Yes.
and the law of decay. So, as you stated in a classic Torg, the deep mist, which you couldn't see more than a couple of feet in front of you, and your no G well, they didn't really have GPS back then, but your compasses went
Compass.
haywire. You couldn't tell direction. You couldn't see. Your stuff was decaying. Was so harsh that yes, people did not want to go there. And then when they wanted to, then they made sure they all had spears and just tech, whatever it
Appropriate
was,
stuff.
stuff that they wouldn't have to worry about. And with Torg Eternity, they definitely kept aspects in, but made it, even with the Law of Decay, as the card states, it's going to be, it's not going to happen always, and it's either like in your system, it's going to be random. It's not the game master just saying, "Hey, you lost that. Hey, you lost that," and picking the thing, or it's the player picking what item. But it's a little less harsh. But with the salvage and repair as a game master in my home game, I wouldn't necessarily just pick on the if somebody did the player the Law of Decay. I liked your idea of in a game where you can focus on the minute details, doing the okay, your armor gets lowered by a point, here's a possibility. Time passes, okay, your armor gets a little more rusty, here's a possibility, and it gets lowered by one. And then if a player was like, hey, can I repair it so that it doesn't lose more? Well, yeah, you're not going to go up pluses, but you might be able to prevent it from going down, but then you're only going to get two possibilities. You're not going to get the full three. I wouldn't necessarily, without the Law of Decay card coming into play, just having stuff decay on a player character, but I would use this if they left something and then came
Oh,
back to
yeah.
it. Like,
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
We're driving in our, vehicle, in our 4x4, which can get over the terrain and such, but now we get to a cave that it won't fit in. We do our little cave session or however long that takes and come back out. That's when I would have that vehicle possibly, not working, and then use the repair, rules for that. And maybe they'll end up having to walk. Maybe they get the vehicle repaired, but either by feet or wheels, they're going to be able to get to their next objective. So it's more of just a, hey, were you able to do that? So that's kind of why I like the salvage repair rules. And you could also, even though this is specifically Law of Decay, I would use this or something similar in any of the realms. A lot of In my games, the airplane's like crashing in the Nile Empire desert and getting repaired, so that's where I would bring these rules into play also. So Very flavorful. Think about how you use it. Think about if you're going to use it with your Law of Decay Cosm cards or not.
Or
But it.
from a home game standpoint, GMs, think about it as a thing that you do to your players and put an NPC out there that's a salvage and repair NPC that they can encounter and become, create a point of interest that as things degrade, oh, if I take it back to this little spot over here, I know that there's a woman who's a shaman or a Gotak or whatever, or she's a jacket of Lanala, but she also has this salvage and repair ability that she can fix my stuff. And so now I care about this region of the cosm that you've created for other reasons, and you keep them coming back and forth, because then later on you can do stuff to and around and for and about that section, and they care because they're invested in it because they've come back there two or three times to get stuff repaired. And that just makes your world more interesting.
Definitely. So that is the salvage and repair. The next session, or section, sorry, section, deals with new races of the Ground Sloth and the Stalinger, which are both originally were backer archetypes. So they have the Ground Sloth, which is 3 meter tall, so about 10 or so feet tall, a big Ground Sloth. One of their abilities, alien values, is they don't desire or use most equipment. They have collecting tendencies, so they want to collect them all. They got to have them all. So if they get one of something, they want all of that something. But it could be junk or valuable. It's basically more of the collection aspect. Their fur gives them a +2 armor. Their claws are +2 strength damage. They are large, so attacks against them gain the size +2 bonus. I find the slow is pretty. They can't rush, and when they're in foot chases, they're at a -4 penalty, so they don't want to be in any chases. And then the common one between the Ground Sloth and the Stalinger are unique, which is only one Ground Sloth or only one Stalinger Storm Knight is allowed in each game. But let me go on to the Stalinger. The Stalinger are like floating starfish, is what they kind of look like. They have five symmetrical arms radiating out from a central body. In the middle, though, is where they have a little toothy maw that's capable. It says it's capable of vocalization, which I'll get into later. But the Stalinger's native language is based on s touch. They have these little like tentacles that come out of their appendages that they can manipulate, find things. They have an alien body, which they says you cannot wear armor or clothing designed for humans. It costs a +2 to the value chart. They have a gas bladder that kind of allows them to float around in the air. They can't rush for extra movement, but they can fly. They fly about 2 meters. If they do so higher, then they can't do any type of a recovery action. They are an extreme outsider, so they get a -6 to persuasion streetwise, and then again, they are unique. So, Mark, do you have any thoughts on either the Ground Sloth or the Stalinger? I have a lot of thoughts on the
I don't have any home game thoughts on the Ground Sloth or Stalinger other than I probably would never let anybody play one as a home game because I don't see them as interesting. I see them as interesting as a footnote or a side note or a flavor thing that happens in the Living Land or a portion thereof that makes it unique. And beyond that, it to me just seems more difficult to make a functioning team of Storm Knights around one or either one of these. And I don't, from a player standpoint, I have never had a desire to play either one. I don't find them interesting from a player's standpoint. So that's my home game statement. The The Torgonized Play statement is purely straight out of the 1.4 appendix that's on this very book, which the whole book has one paragraph in it, and all it says is all rules items within this book, The Ruins of the Living End, are open access with the following exceptions. Races. Ground sloth and stallingers are restricted. Perks. All ground sloth and stallinger perks are restricted. Scavenger. Any items found using this perk are lost at the end of the mission. And both, all of that is the scavenger reason is just not, it's game balance.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not really a loot system for Torgeturnee, because it's not built around the acquisition of wealth and other things. Torgonized Play has instituted a mission pay, because that's how you get money to buy stuff, or how you can get more stuff, and it keeps game balance. This would horrifically overbalance, put the game out of balance. Mm-hmm. And so you can scavenge stuff and find it, but you lose it at the end of the mission.
Right.
What the restricted perk on the races means from a Torgonized Play standpoint is, if you're a Torgonized player listening to this right now and you really want to play a Stallinger or a Ground Sloth, email me, contact me, hit me up on Discord or Facebook and tell me you really want to play a Stallinger, and we'll work something out. Because what that means is you have to earn a cert for it. And that means that I have to create you a path to earn a cert, which likely means writing a mission that's focused around, with a logical idea, that earns you a cert, the ability to play a Stallinger or a Ground Sloth. And right now, I don't have the time for that.
my thoughts, and I guess they would be similar to for the Ground Sloth. I just have more experience with the Stallinger. So I know the history of why Stallingers are official in Torg Eternity. They were in Classic Torg too. For many years I had the exact same thoughts on you as a Stallinger. I can't imagine ever wanting to play one or having to run one as a game master with a player that was a Stallinger. They couldn't talk in Classic Torg, which was a big difficulty to kind of get past, as they can't even really sign because they just have starfish arms. But there was a time when I thought, you know, a Stallinger in a different reality might work. And I had toyed, I never played it because back then I was the Eternal Game Master. But I thought, you know, like a Stallinger magician or something would kind of be a little fun. Yeah, you could be a miracle worker, but with a cyber witch or something could be interesting with cybernetics and stuff. So then a little bit before Torg Eternity came out, when it was being discussed, or even a little bit before I realized Torg Eternity was coming out, I had reinvigorated my old longtime Classic Torg game. And my brother wanted to be a Stallinger businessman using the Nippon Tech at the time, which was what Pan Pacifica was in Classic Torg. Be the businessman, basically a millionaire Stallinger who sat behind a computer and ran an organization. And he gave himself a Tech 24 like voice emulator type thing. I thought that was interesting, so we did that for a while, and then Torg Eternity came out and decided, okay, we're going to convert everybody's characters from Classic Torg to Torg Eternity. And then he came up with the Electric Samurai Stallinger idea, because his Stallinger's name was Shuriken. So, of course, you want to be an Electric Samurai that has five swords sticking out, and then you spin like a throwing star. And at that time, a lot of the Torg Eternity rules in the core rulebook, that was the only book that had been published at the time, did not have a lot of things that were in the game that I was playing, so I had to come up with rules. So I came up with some Stalinger rules. I wrote those down, put them in my product on the Infiniverse Exchange, now the Ulysses Scriptorum, on DriveThruRPG, the Paraverse. And then, as an April Fool's joke, and I don't remember if this was on, if this was YouTube or Facebook or Instagram, I don't remember which platform it was on, but they talked about the upcoming Living Land crowdfunding, and they gave like a Stalinger April Fool's joke, you know, was the new Living Land race was going to be officially the Stalinger. And then after the haha April Fool's, there was a little statement that said, hey, if you do wish, you know, if you do wish to have a Stalinger, they actually pointed to my product. And at that time, I had nothing official to do with Torg Eternity whatsoever. So that kind of like, oh, they've read my product, because they were like, hey, you can look at this guy's stuff. And they said, there will never be a Stalinger in Torg Eternity unless one of the backer archetypes is bought and that person says Stalinger. So what, of course, happens is somebody wanted a Stalinger and took that April Fool's joke and turned that into a backer archetype, and then that was added so that it could have some more perks and stuff to flesh out the Stalinger a little bit in this Ruins of the Living Land. So that's kind of the story of how Stalingers made their way into Torg Eternity. So that Stalinger lasted the entire game campaign of that group, which they went through several mega adventures, culminating in the Relics of Power Redux, where the Stalinger sacrificed his life so that everybody else could live. So the Stalinger was a hero. That was just something that 30 years ago, when I first saw Stalingers, I would have been like, that can't happen. So while I can look at it's a cool artwork of the sloth, but he kind of looks like, you know, like happy-go-lucky, Gomer Pyle-ish attitude from the picture. I can't say I don't like the ground sloth, because I've never seen one played. It's just something that I would be hesitant to play, but if somebody played it right, I would at least be more open to the idea than I once was. I will say the unique thing is unique, because it does say only one ground sloth Storm Knight is allowed in each game. That is such a definitive statement that the differences between a game for you, a game for me, a game for to organize play can mean a lot of different things. So that would be one that I definitely would say to the game master, you're going to have to decide what that means. Because if you're just playing, here's this group of four or five people that are playing with me, and we're getting the same characters, and we're going to go through every mega adventure, and we're going to go through every, you know, one act adventure, and it's just going to be these five people, then I could see saying, okay, in the course of this whole campaign, you're probably only going to see one ground sloth or one Stalinger. But if you have a game world that has gone on since, like mine from Classic Torg, that spans a period of 30 years, as well as people have come in and out of it. I've probably had at least 50 players during the course of that time. Then if two people played a Ground Sloth or a Stalinger, it's not that big of a deal. I know that in the past I've limited the archetypes used to be called templates. I limited templates. I was like, only one person, you know, there's over 100 templates. Don't play a duplicate. And that became a thing because I had like four different people want to be the Dark Avenger. And that template was just so tempting, I guess. But I
That's
then,
just a good role-playing game rule, though.
but it was like a hey, don't step on somebody else's toes. You know, if they're
Yeah.
the one playing that, play something else. There's over 100. But what happened then was I had a Amazon that was in the classic Torg game a long, long time ago, and then Torg Eternity came out, and a new player, not knowing that an Amazon was played, was like, hey, I'd like to play an Amazon. And then I was like, okay, 25 years has passed. I'll allow another Amazon, and then that's your mentor. And then that was a connection to the past. So there's things to be able to do with that. So that's why I just want to say, although at first this unique thing sounds perfectly acceptable, your miles may vary depending on how many people you have and how long your game world and your own Cosmverse lasts. But yeah, they're interesting. I at one time hated to say it, but we actually had a successful Stalinger, which is crazy. But then we get into some perks. The first one is an Eidos perk, Heliopteryx, which means sun wing. Prerequisite dexterity 10 plus. It says it's one of the rarest adaptations for Eidos. It's basically they have wings, pterodactyl wings of the fingers, so that they can glide and even fly as long as they aren't carrying anything with a minimum strength requirement. They can rush basically and use claws while flying, but they can't use weapons or items that require hands while flying. It does say that it's a birth adaptation and it's only available upon character creation. It's not subject to changing upon transformation to another Cosm, I would say, or back if you had like an Eidos that transformed into something else and then came back. I wouldn't allow it to be a winged Eidos. So, what are your thoughts on the Heliopteryx?
So let me start off with this perk must be taken at character creation. I could be convinced, but you have to work very, very hard. I do not see this as something that you can. I want to build a Pan-Pacifica Heliopteryx. I don't see you doing that. I don't see a way that you can present to me a path that makes sense, because transformations like that, in my opinion, should happen during gameplay. Now, does Torgonized play allow for elves in the Cyber Papacy and things of that nature? There are rules for it. I don't like, personally, I don't like that. I think that the way that those need to be unique and special, in that you took your Eilish elf to the Cyber Papacy and you disconnected and you transformed, and now there's a game story reason behind whatever happened, instead of, I see this as a really cool way to game the system and get this really cool combination that I couldn't get otherwise. I am 100% gonna stand on that for the Heliopteryx. There is no way you're going to start your Heliopteryx with frickin' cyber arms for their wings and Trigon weapon mounts, so that you can be this like gliding frickin' armed aircraft lizard thing. That's just not happening. That said, I really like the Heliopteryx as a race, if you will. We played a home game that had, a pterodactyl has that silent P in front of it, Petiter, and that's they had a anyway. It was Rod's wife played Petiter, and we just called him Petiter all the time because it had the silent T out there, and she played a Heliopter. It was a lot of fun. They're fun characters. If you want to build one and play it, they are. It's yeah, you're not hiding that when you go to the Arorsch or the cyber papacy or anywhere else. You're not hiding that. So,
and even in the living land, because it says it's rare, so you would be, yep. Oh, it's that Eidonos.
I mean, it almost feels like it ought to be, I almost think it ought to be, you know, an automatic outsider just because it's that difficult, that different, but it isn't. So, yeah, GMs, if you're going to let this one play, it's going to be fun. You'll have a good time. It'll be unique and different, and you'll be challenged, but it is fun.
Right, and as a point that you made, this being a, hey, I'm going to choose a Helioptrix, and I'm going to start out in the Cyber Papacy or Pan Pacific or anything, to me that is very different than the scenario that I talked about the Stallinger. The Stallinger was like, I need my player to be able to talk to other players. And with them, you know, Stallinger's not being able to talk, that's difficult. So if he's Pan Pacifica, I could say he has a high-tech voice box, you know, to do it. So in that case, it wasn't to get something better than everybody else to min-max. It was to get something playable in my game. know? Especially at the time we were doing Roll20. So if somebody can't talk through, you know, your whatever voice app you're using to play your game in Roll20, there you can't do anything. You can't mime or anything like that. Whereas the Helioptrix, you can definitely see how somebody would come into that going, oh, if I get this and I add this and I add this, I can get, you know, this super dactyl.
Super dactyl. That's an Isle Empire.
Yeah, right. And a point, the Stallinger at one time in the adventure did disconnect and transform to a, at the time, like I said, it was Classic Torque, so into Land Below, which wasn't quite as bad as Back to the Living Land, but then he lost his voice. So he had to say actions that his Stallinger was doing until... I think before this came out and it said they vocalized, I gave a perk and said you could buy a perk to talk. So he ended up buying a perk to talk. But let's move on. Then we have this interest. I think it's interesting, at least Faith perk called Holy Reaper. Two or more adds in Faith and Survival. And it says any melee weapon or unarmed attack you make against a plant gains plus one BD of damage. This applies to all plantings of Gospog as well. So what are your thoughts on Holy Reaper?
I think it would be I don't see it as a bad perk. It's limited in use. Gospog are everywhere.
Yeah.
And so it has a, you know, I see it more as more of a an early game low level usage than I do later game. Although you know what? I see it as an early and a later game usage and not so much in the middle game, because Gospog tend to get tired. People get tired of Gospog. They show up because they're ubiquitous. The Gaunt Man has given Gospog to everybody, and some High Lords use them more than others. But from a GM standpoint, you can only do so many Gospog encounters. I like when I'm trying to put something together and I'm out of ideas for unique and interesting and whatever, I'll just have him run into a Gospog field. Mm-hmm. And I'll readily admit that sometimes it's lazy writing, but almost every single time I do it, it fits, and it fits really well. And when you start looking at that, you know, oh, we're just going to put Gospog here. They stumble into a Gospog field. Hey, you know, that they're in triple canopy jungle and, you know, pulling those fronds back. You don't see what's 3 feet beyond where it's you're seeing. You see 3 feet and that's it. And when you pull the next set of fronds back, you could be in the middle of something completely unknown. So having them stumble out of, you know, the jungle into a first, second, third, fourth planning Gospog field, that it totally fits, right? And that happens every single time I do it in any cosm. I'm like, suddenly, oh, here's how this fits in really well with what I'm doing here to have Gospog. And Gospog are a unique Torg creature that, based on if you know how they come about and you know how they are grown, and if you don't, you really, really need to, because they're freaking creepy and they're fantastic, and everybody that runs into them goes, ew. And they are really good for Torg Eternity, because they really are good Torg Eternity villains. Well, not even villains. Threats.
Threats.
They work. And but people, if you can't throw them in all the time, just here and there. And when people start forgetting that they're in Torg Eternity, hit them with Gospog. Because and hit them with the second, third, and fourth planning Gospog periodically, because they are underused. First planning Gospog everywhere at low levels, because they're first planning Gospog. They're mooks. You just mow them down. It's great fun. Fifth planning Gospog, they are not mooks. And when you need your Storm Knights to be going, oh crap, oh no, and get worried, give them a fifth planning Gospog. But two and three and four, which are really unique for each cosm, they're really fun and they're really different and really unique. They don't get used that much. They get passed over. So use them.
Yeah, I like this perk because, again, it's not something that you're going to be able to use all the time. But in Torg Eternity, I think you're going to be able to use it enough. And when those times matter, when usually Gospog are not a known threat. Like you said, it's stumbling across the Gospog field, or a High Lord sending Gospog of higher plantings after you. Or you usually don't go in expecting Gospog. So at the beginning, when you have all those low level, you know, first planning Gospog that are the same in every single reality, if you have a player, or if you're the player and you have a Storm Knight with this, this is pretty good. BD of damage. If you have Relentless and do an all-out attack, then you have a plus 2 BD of damage against Gospog. Add Whirlwind, your first perk. You're a Gospog-killing, you know, machine. And then, like you said, even at the higher game stage, when you do get those third, fourth, and possibly that fifth planting Gospog who's like super tough, you still feel like this perk is doing something, because again, because this thing is a Gospog fifth planting, yes, but I get to still add an extra BD against it. That makes you feel really cool when you get that extra BD that nobody else gets because you got this. So I'm really glad they specified, because I could see where if they ended it at the melee weapon or unarmed attack you make against a plant gains a plus 1 BD of damage, period, that there would be people arguing about, does it affect Gospog, does it not? That statement adds everything to it. Because, yes, it's going to be nice against your carnivorous plants or whatever, but adding that Gospog language just is like it's like the perfection of this perk that I think is just really cool and probably not used as much, but I think it's a good solid perk. Because the time you experience Gospogs are not when you expect it. You almost never go in expecting a Gospog. I would note, this would not apply to Xeno Gospog, because Xeno Gospog are created in a different method, it's not plant material added to bodies. It's genetic gene mod type stuff. But all the other realities, it's gonna work and work good, whether you're low or high level. So let's go to the one Ground Sloth perk, which this one I find interesting. Distortion Aura is everything within 2 meters of the Ground Sloth becomes stymied. Attacks against the creature at range suffer a similar negative 2 penalty when passing through the aura. So what do you think about Distortion Aura and the Ground Sloth?
Why? I mean, I don't understand where this comes from. Because they're super slow. And, I mean, what? Okay. What?
It's like they have an individual reality to make everything
Yeah.
slow.
Yeah, I get the I get, that the distortion field causes you could have just said that. I mean, I guess you could have just said all attacks against the ground sloth are at minus two, instead of saying that anything within 2 meters becomes stymied. But I mean, I guess that the verbiage I would like to see on this, and maybe it's omitted on purpose, it says everything within 2 meters of the ground sloth. So that buddy of yours who's trying to pick the lock when you come, hey, what you doing? And now he's stymied for
Right,
picking the lock
lock.
because you're leaning over his shoulder. So, you affect that. This means everybody that in the party is never going to be more closer than 6 feet to the ground sloth. So when I come in to do first aid on you, I'm minus two because I'm stymied.
Yeah, it's just kind of really weird.
Yeah, I don't get it.
And even against opponents, it basically is just a cancellation for it being large. Large attacks against the ground sloth gain plus two bonus. So if you're attacking it within the aura, you get a plus two, but then a negative two penalty. So it just becomes a zero. So yeah, distortion aura, I think as a perk is interesting. I don't understand why it's a ground sloth perk of just the I'm slow, so you're going to be slow also. But interesting, just not sure what the game or what the what I want to say the history behind this perk is. So then we get into prowess perks. The first one is mechanic. Take 1 minute to roll a science test for repairs on a damaged item instead of an hour. Only one attempt per hour is allowed. Taking full hour grants a plus two bonus to the test. The character may spend a possibility to test after only one action. So thoughts on mechanic?
It's right up there with scavenger. Same reason for scavenger. I see this more as an interesting thing to give an NPC that you build a location around, because anybody with the Law of Decay being so prevalent in the Living Land, anyone who can do these kinds of things would be highly sought after by people not native to the Living Land. Right, because the natives of the Living Land don't need to fix things. They just grow another rock shoot and shape it into what they need, and off they go. That's their that that it's the certain the law of decay isn't the law of decay to the people in the Living Land. The law of decay is the circle of life to the people of the Living Land. The law of decay is to everybody else the law of decay, because I come in there with all my cool stuff, and then all my cool stuff slowly breaks down because it's exceeding the axioms of the Living Land. So I would see the Delphi Council as significantly wanting to try and either find these people or plant these people, because if I'm going to send missions, so I'm the Delphi Council and I want to send missions into the Living Land, I know that my people are going to need this because they're going to get affected by the Law of Decay. And so I need waypoints, say like safe houses in the Cyber Papacy that La Resistance can set up, that kind of thing. Mechanics and scavengers set up. I'm getting ahead of us a little bit, but mechanics and scavengers get set up in the Living Land, so that if your mission requires you to drive a Tech 22 vehicle through the Living Land, you are going to break down. And if you do not, and I say that emphatically because you are going to break down. And if you don't plan for your vehicle to fail, and it's a requirement that you keep the vehicle running, you're going to fail. So this I could see making a whole mission about, we're going to go build a spot for this mechanic team guy, gal, whatever, to be, so that when we come back and do missions out of this area to try and affect the Red Jaw or degrade Barukha's forces in this area and win over hearts and minds for the Delphi Council, we need a mechanic, because we're going to we're gonna need him. So here's our mission to see the mechanic and make sure the Adinos don't try and kill and eat him. Something like that. I like the mechanic perk. It's neat, but I don't know how I would take that or why I would take that as a player.
Right. The thing that I've been thinking of, this would have to be your concept. And why I say that is because I did have a player. It was in Classic Torg, but his concept was a mechanic. And he played the template, the Realm Runner, which at that time it was half dealing with reality stuff, but the other half was just driving. So he had every vehicle skill and all the repair skills and stuff, which all fall under like science or the vehicle skill plus your mind adds. I could see a player like that having a character that's his. I mean, the character's name was Wrench. He was a monkey wrench. He was, the garage mechanic who became a Storm Knight.
Yeah.
That's how I could see this a player picking this perk. It's not bad. Yeah, I can see where it could come in useful, especially in the all the times planes crash and stuff and vehicles break down. But unless that's th this wouldn't be something that you would just pick up as a spare perk, I guess is what I'm saying. You would leave it to an NPC, like you said, or this would be your character concept, like the part, my character is a mechanic, so that's the reason I'm getting this thing. So let's move on to Scavenger. So in Scavenger, to find a specific kind of item, you discard a Cosm card and roll a find test. The difficulty number is the value of the item. On a success, gain the item. Otherwise, a similar item of the value rolled Game Master's Call is found. So I know you said in organized play, the item is temporary. It's not like I gain it forever, so people can't just sell it and make a bunch of money that way. But other than that, what do you think about the card? You can give up a Cosm card to kind of almost do a to get a fine test to find something.
It's like a connection or an idea card for stuff. And I think it's super useful. It's like it is like an idea card. Like I know I need, if I only had a Holocaust cloak,
Right.
right? There's your Princess Bride reference for the podcast. If you tossed out a card and the Holocaust cloak has a DN of 15, now I got to roll, a find test, a DN 15, and look, I found one stuck under a rock. Now the GM's got to come up with why did I find, a carburetor jammed under a rock in the Living Land or whatever. That's fun exercise for the GM, but that's, I mean, it doesn't limit you to, you want this thing, whatever this thing is. And now I want EMP grenades. Okay, those are DN, 13. Here's my card. I'm throwing out a reconnect card, or no, I'm throwing out a transfer card because nobody is ever using those, and I don't see me using it. So here's my role to try and find that. Oh, look, we found EMP grenades. Why are they here? You come up against a we can get in there if we only had a cyber deck so we could hack this system. We don't have a decker who can get us in there, but if we had one, we could fake the move and try a straight mind roll or whatever. Oh, looks, someone discarded a cyber deck here. You can f this according to this, you can find anything. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, th this was one I think also is good for Tharkold characters with a scavenger type concept. I actually did take this with my Tharkold character Ivan. I basically didn't want him to just be the same melee person that everybody else plays when they buy the exact same
Giant
perks, and was like, okay, he.
impact hammer.
Yeah, impact hammer plus, relentless plus whirlwind plus this plus that, equals your cookie cutter. And I was like, what would be a interesting perk to get as just a, hey, here, this adds a little useful flavor to the character. And because it does take your Cosm card, so if you pull a good Cosm card, you'll probably want to use your Cosm card, because you have to give up your Cosm card to activate this. But it is good in case you get one of those Cosm cards that you just don't want to play. I mean, we've
Oh,
talked
it is a
about,
Cosm card. Okay.
we have talked about always play your Cosm cards, even the bad ones. But there are some
Oh.
times where you might just be, eh, I'd rather do a fine test, but it's a resource, it's an important resource that you're giving up to make that fine test. So I think that's a nice balance. Again, I used it a couple of times, got it, but it was a very, I thought it was very flavorful to add to a Tharkold character. I definitely can see why it's in the Living Land, though, as well.
I missed that it was a Cosm card. I thought it was just a regular card. I completely missed that.
Yeah.
That's so that I guess that's. I like the fact that it's a using, like you said, it's a using a Cosm card. Because right in the last act I was running, or in the act I'm running now for one of the tables, they got a Cosm card and it's completely useless. They're like, and it doesn't say discard. Like, if nobody has any
Right.
spells, discard and draw another. It's just like, oh well, you got stuck with it. I'd like to see some more stuff like this to where you could choose to use that gives you the flexibility that your Cosm card becomes a different resource if you want it to be. And that way when you get saddled with the one that's like either, oh, I'm not doing this to anybody, or well, this just doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work in the group, so.
You can do something else with it.
And there's a lot of things that cost possibilities or this or that. This is something that's a little bit different. It's a Cosm card. And again, you're really going to have to think or not. It's obvious. This we cannot use this Cosm card, so sometime during this act I'm going to scavenge. Or a ooh, this is kind of a good, but we could scavenge. So then you have that trade-off of what do you think's more important, the Cosm card or the
Scavenge law
scavenge thing.
rockets.
So,
I would scavenge law rockets all
rockets.
the time.
But having said that, we'll go ahead and stop. We'll pick up next time with the other perks that are left. But until then, you can email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. And we'll read your emails, and we'll answer your questions, we'll comment on your comments, etc. And until then, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.